History isn't just a bunch of names and dates and facts. It's the collection of all the stories throughout human history that explain how and why we got here. Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, where we look at the forgotten, neglected, strange, and even counterfactual stories that made our world what it is. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Everyone, Scott here. A quick preamble before we start. What we're about to hear is a snippet from an episode from Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, a show that looks at the historical accuracy of films and also provides film analysis. Steve and I did a multi-part series a few years ago called Hollywood Hates History, where we looked at a number of movies and judged whether or not they were historically accurate. For most cases, the answer was no. Now, of course, we're history nerds, and we nerd out pretty hard with details, but we're not trying to nitpick. We understand that film has to make a few compromises to be compelling. Is there a film about the Roman Empire that takes place in the 5th century, but they're using costumes from the 1st century? We know that costume departments have limited budget, and few people in the film-going audience can tell the difference. Does a character from the 18th century have questionably modern takes on gender and racial relations? All right, well, we understand that you have to make your protagonist sympathetic, and if you're going to have a character from 50 or 100 or 200 years ago say the exact things about different racial groups that a person from that time period would say, they're going to fall out of favor with the audience pretty quickly. What bothers us is when screenwriters try to use the past for their own messaging purposes, and they completely distort the stories that took place. One movie that we'll endlessly pick on until the end of time is Kingdom of Heaven, where Orlando Bloom, aka Legolas from The Lord of the Rings, is a crusader, and the entire movie is a metaphor for either the Israeli-Palestinian conflict or the Iraq War, take your pick. Sure, you can make plenty of movies addressing those issues, and I'm sure you can find parallels with the Crusades, but they completely distort the actual historicity of the Crusades so much that it's unrecognizable. I don't want to get too far and start ranting about that movie all over again, so you can go back and listen to the episode if you want to. Anyway, I recommend you check out Steve's show Beyond the Big Screen and his other show History of the Papacy, both of which you can find at parthenonpodcast.com. Here, you're going to hear a snippet of him and a guest analyze Stanley Kubrick's 2001 Space Odyssey, where they talk about things historically, where the movie jumps to the pre-hominid past of Earth, then go to an alternate 2001, and they look at things from a historical angle, but also from a film criticism angle. A lot of good things going on here. So again, if you want to listen to a show, go to parthenonpodcast.com.
This is Beyond the Big Screen Podcast with your host, Steve Guerra.
2001 A Space Odyssey is one of the most important movies of all time. Today, I'm joined by Eric Fogg of the wonderful Reconsider podcast to discuss this masterpiece of cinema. So at this point, I shouldn't even have to introduce Eric. If people haven't listened to the Blade Runner series that you presented with us, then drop everything right now. Go listen to that, then come back.
It's iconic. Yeah.
I'll just briefly introduce 2001 Space Odyssey, and then we'll jump right into it. So the movie is a 1968 film produced and directed by Stanley Kubrick, and it's based on a short story by Arthur C. Clarke. And Arthur C. Clarke wrote the screenplay. Now, I've read the short story, and it really does not prepare you at all for the movie. So don't feel like you have to read the short story to watch the movie. They're like completely different entities.
Yeah.
Now, it's difficult to summarize the plot of this movie. You really have to watch it and then maybe watch it again, then listen to this podcast, then watch it again. But we're going to address some of the key themes of this movie. And really, the big thing to think about going into this movie is that it's broken down into four acts. They're connected, but they're not connected. We'll get into that.
Yeah.
So there's the far distant past on the African savanna, and the actors are a group of pre-human hominids. Then the second part is on the U.S. lunar base, which is supposed to be the present time, which was the future in 1968 and is the distant past now, 2001. Then we have the Jupiter space mission, which will feature the famous HAL, which I'm sure most people are familiar with. And then the final scene in the Baroque bedroom. So, Eric, where do we start with this?
Oh, my gosh. I mean, I think we need to provide some context briefly for those who haven't seen it. For those who have seen it like five times, you know, sorry. You know, you're like, oh, my God, this is my favorite movie. Let's hear about it. Like, you can probably skip 2 minutes of this. But the, you know, the thing about 2001 is that it's very non-traditional storytelling, right? Like, most movies that we see have a coherent singular narrative from start to end. And actually, there was a professor of mine who's actually a history professor, not a film professor, but he told me most sitcoms you ever see follow the path of the golden calf from the Bible, from the Old Testament, where everything's fine, everything's hunky dory, right? And but then people are like dissatisfied with their lot in life for some reason, and they get some crazy idea and they go execute it, and then things go terribly wrong. And then they have to fix it, which is like getting forgiveness from God. And then they're back to where they started and they're more satisfied with what they had. And not every movie is like that, but you can explain a movie's plot typically with a few sentences just like that. And the way that we were struggling at the beginning of this episode said like, well, there's kind of a plot. Like, there's not really a plot. There's a sequence of things that happen. And so the typical plot of a movie is that there's this like core tension, right, that has to be resolved. And it could be like there are zombies and we have to survive. Like, that's the core tension. Or like spy versus spy. Or, you know, these two people, they're in love with each other, but they're not good at communicating. So we now have a rom-com. And that core tension is not part of really three of the four acts. You know, that Hal is a, like, act three with Hal is a very classic, like, it's a movie in itself, right? You have an AI that goes crazy and you have to like find a way to deal with it. And there's a lot of movies that are just like that, but act one on the Savannah, act two, you know, and sorry, there is tension in act one, I guess. It's that like survival is hard, but it's not resolved in a conventional way where like a character makes a decision, you know, et cetera. There's a very deliberate deus ex machina that just goes like, okay, now it's different. Now things are different, right? Now the apes know how to use tools. Same thing with like visiting the lunar base. Like, nothing gets resolved. They show up and then like, you know, and it goes like, and they like clutch their heads and that's the end of the act. You're like, what? Why? Why did this happen? And then same with the Baroque bedroom. You know, you have, he shows up and he ages and then he's the star child. And you're like, but why? What happened? You know, and one of the ways I love that you talked about this, Steve, is that this is a movie that is about experiencing things, that like you are in the shoes of these characters experiencing what they're experiencing through this like audiovisual roller coaster or like tour de force. And it was one of the first, I mean, oh God, there's so much about this film that I love. That's not just in the content, but how it's presented. About like the decisions that Kubrick makes and the innovations in visual effects, the musical decisions he makes and the audio, like controversial or not controversial, but like radical audio decisions, like having long periods of silence, all this stuff that's meant to just like have you be there in order to experience, to your point, the themes of the movie. And often we experience a theme through seeing a story play out and we go, ah, that story, I reflect to it in, you know, I resonate with it in my life. But we don't resonate with any of these stories, not in our lives. And so we experience the themes of the movie through radically different ways. And so like, that is something that if you're going to go watch it for the first time or the second time, because you need to see this movie multiple times to appreciate it. You need to understand that, like, don't expect a plot in the way that is conventionally, that you're conventionally used to, because you will find something missing. You have to approach this movie from another angle.
I like the idea of the deus ex machina of the black obelisk or the monolith. I guess that, yeah, it's a monolith. It's not quite an obelisk, but it carries through, and you can kind of take it at first whack that it's a literal, that this is the literal thing from like an alien, maybe, that like is the thing that gets people and humanity to the next like quantum leap in civilization. But it's also a more, and I think more of a literary device of saying that we've made it to this point and we're ready for the next point in time and in evolution.
Yes. Yes. These monoliths show up after periods of extraordinary pain and strife with the, you know, kind of like with humans interfacing with the world. Now, the second one, maybe not so much. There is pain and strife because, like, we see the monolith three distinct times. We specifically don't see it in Act Three. We see it in the transition from Act Three to Act Four. So again, Hal is kind of its own story that sets up why we go to Act Four. But yeah, in Act One, the monolith comes in this period where, you know, you see the early hominids, you know, cowering in caves from hearing jaguars outside or saber-toothed tigers or whatever they are. And then they, you know, and they get their butts kicked by another band of apes. And then the monolith shows up and, like, they're able to advance. And it seems like it's a good thing, but it's not even necessarily a good thing. It's just different now, yeah, right? So, like, they're able to, exactly. They're able to solve that problem, but, like, it introduces all sorts of new problems that you get with civilization. And, you know, the second monolith shows up during this period of, like, Cold War between, you know, on the Russian and the American moon bases. You feel this, like, low level, very civil, but the same kind of tension. And of course, like, if we think of the themes, those two bands of apes, right, they're just called Americans and Russians now, right? And and in the first act, they're competing over, like, water. You know, they're competing over, like, a little like pond of water to get access to those resources. And now they're competing over the moon. And so, like, nothing's actually gotten better. It's just more advanced now. And then they run into the monolith again. And the Americans are the ones that got it, just like, you know, and then they're able to send their people to Jupiter, just in the same way that one band of apes got the monolith and the other didn't in Act One. And then we finally see the monolith again after the harrowing, traumatic ordeal with Hal, in which Dave is completely alone, and he runs into the monolith, and, like, life does not get better for Dave after that either. So the reason I think that's so important is that it changes the nature of this Deus Ex Machina, where typically it's kind of frowned upon. Like, it's not a good storytelling device, because you go, like, oh, well, this character didn't do anything to solve the problem. This is unsatisfying, but the problem's not being solved. But it is always there to sort of, like, address a pain or a tension.
That second act on the moon base, that really gave us a actual sci-fi scene of what Kubrick envisioned what approximately 30 years later would look like. And I thought that was and it was just so well done. Like, I think that's one of the things about this movie, is that it really didn't, it's not like watching a lot of movies from the late 60s, early 70s. Like, I don't feel like this movie aged at all.
Yeah, that's one of the things that's so incredible about it is I'll show this movie to people and then I'll ask them, when was it made? And they're like, maybe the 80s? Like, there's not a lot of CGI, so maybe the 80s is, like, no, man, 1968, 53 years ago. And I was like, right? Like, I barely know people that are that old. And so that's not true. He's such a master of visual effects. And the only thing that seems really odd about the visual effects in this movie is that he spends a lot of time on a single effect, right? So we're used to, like, visual effect, boom, 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 right? In some movies that I love, we do that. Like, Fury Road is like, bang, 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 bang. And you're like, I can't keep up. And this one, he's very indulgent, right? He, like, spends a lot of time, like, with even just, like, with the waitress on the TWA spaceship, right? Like, walking around the drum very slowly, right? Or then, like, floating very slowly through the passenger compartment. The ship landing on the moon base, all this stuff happens super slowly. And I don't know. I mean, some of it's just like, it's just the feel of the movie that, look, in, you know, you're Kubrick's trying to help you experience that you're dealing with vast distances here, right? And so you're not just, like, boop, popping from place to place in this starship. But it's also the case that I wonder how much Kubrick was just showing off, right? The guy is a big show off, and we need to, like, know a little bit about him as well, that he did stuff that people had never seen before, like the idea of like this person walking upside down on the screen. Well, what he did was he had this big drum that was rotating slowly to be able to do that. But I was like, holy crap, we're like floating. We'd never seen that before. We'd never seen a human floating in a scene as if in zero G, or at least not convincingly. And
yeah,
and so you get these awesome. I mean, and I'm going to withhold talking about the Stargate, which is my favorite scene, but until we get to it. But yeah, that what that means is like this pace is slow, and that slow pace makes it feel a little bit odd and out of time. But other than that. I agree. It's totally ageless. Kubrick's a genius. He's my favorite director.
What do you think that second act was for you? How was that getting us from the hominids to the Jupiter mission? Like, what do you think? How was that scene and that act meant to get us there?
It does feel very transition. It feels like a transition, right? It feels like it doesn't really justify itself. It doesn't stand alone. And I think that's intentional. So, and here's why. We know that, some of the music or the music that's played at like the beginning and the end of the movie is Thus Spoke Zarathustra by Wagner, right? And that's the music. It's the ba, 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 bo, 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 bo. That's Thus Spoke Zarathustra. And if we've read Thus Spoke Zarathustra, which I happen to have, one thing Zarathustra says is that man is a rope stretched between the animal and the overman or the ubermensch, right? So Nietzsche sees man as a transition. Like we are an interstitial species between where we came from and where we're going. And there is this ultimate place that we are going. And we're in the middle of it. And that's why Act Two feels so funny to us, because it feels like we're just passing through, right? Like we're on the starship and we're experiencing being on the starship. And then like there's the really tense conversation with the Russians, because we don't want to tell the Russians that we found a monolith. So we're like, oh yeah, there's totally a plague. And they're like, oh shit, it's a big deal. And then like we get to the moon, and then we have this conference. That oh my gosh, I forget our man's name, but he hosts this conference where he's like very authoritarian about it, and everyone's like very uncomfortable, but they're nodding along because they have to, And then they go check out the monolith, and it screams at them, and then we're done. And so you kind of get at Act Two going like, what's going on? But again, you have to remember that Kubrick is there's a reason he plays Thus Spoke Zarathustra. It's not just because it sounds cool. It's because he's telling the story of the transition from animal to the overman, the star child. And that's why it feels so transient the whole time. And again, the reason he spends a lot of time in it is because, one, he does want to paint you this. You know, he's trying to do a few things at once. He's trying to paint this like awesome sci-fi vision. Between the starship, the way station, it's a space station where like, you know, you transition from one ship to another, the moon base, the little flyer going from the moon base to the site, and then the site itself. It's all great visual sci-fi. But he's also trying to do two other things. One, he's trying to recreate that conflict, that tension between bands of apes. And two, he's trying to show this transitionatory interstitial thing. And one of the reasons like we really know is that this is a transition is that at like the end of Act One, right, when like the ape is like slow motion pounding away with the bone because he's like so excited that he's got this power now, he tosses it into the air, right? And it transitions into being the starship. Right. And of course, that's symbolic of that moment was the beginning of this arc, this inevitable arc towards this new moment. And everything that kind of comes out of that is because of the monolith, like this inevitable extension of a series of events that it set off. And if you take the monolith symbol literally as these aliens are popping this thing here, which like, it's in the movie, it's kind of hard not to, because like we don't meet the aliens, but we do get to the aliens' home, right? So like you get the sense like they probably did put it there, that like that, you know, we had Act Two is where man has finished this arc that started with that bone and ended with the lunar base. And, you know, and then the monolith, what they discover is that the monolith is essentially pointing to Jupiter. And so we can begin the, like, the journey. This is, and that's the Odyssey. Step three, Act Three is the beginning of the Odyssey. And, it's time to get to the other end of this tightrope between man and the Overmensch or the Übermensch and realize what man is meant to become. And, so that's how I interpret Act Two. And, you know, I skipped over like all of the actual, you know, it's where all the dialogue is, or most of the dialogue is. It's where most of the storytelling is. I mean, you have like our man calling his kid at home for some reason. It's really just to show us Kubrick's vision of the future. And so if it feels a little odd, it's because he's trying to do.
All right, that is it for today. If you would like to see show notes for this episode, along with all my others, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. That's the name of the podcast network that I'm a part of, along with James Early's Key Battles of American History, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen and History of the Papacy, and other great history shows as well. If you'd like to support History Unplugged, the two easiest ways to do so are to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. The second way is to join our membership program, and if you do so, you'll get completely ad-free episodes of the entire back catalog, which is 600 episodes and growing. Just go to patreon.com/unplug. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.